I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Haroon Mogal, wrote recently for Cincinnati.com, Islam is the fastest growing faith. By the end of the century, one out of three people in the world may be Muslim by faith or ancestry. We cannot navigate a complex, volatile world without knowing about its constituent parts. Mogal wrote a memoir 5 years ago, How to Be a Muslim, where he described how he has wrestled with his faith as a son of Pakistan immigrants who believed in a conservative Islam. His new book, 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future, is a continuation of that conversation, mining the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad to fashion a religion that speaks to the modern world, that questions orthodoxy and embraces openness and pluralism. Well, we have a lot to talk about. Haroon Mogal sitting across from me in our Philadelphia studio. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. I would actually like to start at the beginning. You grew up in as you described in your first book, very religious household. What kind of Muslim were you taught to be as a kid?
So I did grow up in a very religious household, and I had the added challenge that my mother's family was and is a scholarly family. So some of my ancestors going back, or maybe more of them than I can count, had written books and poetry and literature. And so unlike some Muslims who grew up in religious households, it wasn't just you have to do this because we say so. It's you have to do this, and here are 25 arguments that will help you understand why you have to do this. So it made it
a lot. Not a fair fight, right?
It was definitely not a fair fight. The deck was stacked against me from the very beginning. But my life has really been a journey of trying to understand how do I want to relate to this tradition, what part of the tradition is relevant to me and where I live, and now as someone who has kids in his life, the question then becomes, how do I want to pass this on, and what do I want to pass on? And certainly I think that's a question every person of faith, or really any person, confronts when they think about continuity. In my case, it's with a religion that, as you said, is very prevalent in many parts of the world and is certainly a part of a lot of conversations in America, but is often, unfortunately, quite misunderstood.
I want to get to all of that, but you also wrote recently about, and I think this was during Ramadan, that growing up in the family that you grew up in, that you got religious confidence. That was the word you used, religious confidence.
Absolutely. And I'm so grateful to my parents, especially my mother. I actually dedicated this most recent book to the memory of my mother. One thing she did that's so remarkable, among the many remarkable things she did, is instill in me a desire to learn about the faith on my own and give me the confidence and the tools to be able to do that. And that's something, unfortunately, a lot of Muslims are not permitted to do and not encouraged to do, especially women in our communities where there's sort of a top-down hierarchical mentality. And maybe we're afraid that people will come to conclusions that we don't agree with. And certainly that's always a possibility, but I don't think that should ever be a deterrent. That's simply a reality, and everyone's right. And so I did have that experience that growing up, getting to college as a young man, I often struggled with my faith, but I often had in the back of my mind this belief that I can figure it out for myself, that I don't have to take at face value what everyone tells me. I can stop and think and say, wait a minute, does that actually make sense?
What were you struggling with? And there was a time, and I don't think this is unusual, people of faith don't embrace but maybe get intrigued by things like atheism or agnosticism or just sort of turning their back entirely on their faith. What were you struggling with?
Well, there were different phases in my life. So when I was in high school, I grew up in New England, and I know we have a connection there.
We do.
And I love New England. I have nothing against it, but I was the only brown kid, the only Muslim kid, and certainly, there was a lot of ignorance. I don't think it was ever hostility, but it was just a lot of ignorance. And when you're that age, it's really hard to stick out and feel like you don't belong. And there wasn't really a lot in terms of a Muslim community around me either. And so I did have a phase where I felt really alienated from Islam. And I often struggled with, I think there's different elements to Muslimness. I think there's Muslim identity, as in being proudly and assertively publicly Muslim. There's Muslim community, being part of spaces where Islam is shaping how we live and prioritize. And then there's, for lack of a better term, although I know it's a loaded term, I don't really like it that much, but piety or worship or a relationship with God and with the texts and traditions of the faith. And for me, the first was always easy, in part because I'm a brown guy named Harun, so you know, I can't really, like, you know, there's not a lot of camouflage available in suburban New England.
No.
And Muslim community, I went to college in New York City, and New York is the biggest Muslim city in the Western Hemisphere. I think about 1 out of 5 Muslims in the U.S. lives in New York City, which is pretty astonishing, and often nobody even realizes that. But the Muslim piety part was something I really struggled with, right? Like, how do I get myself to pray? How do I develop a relationship with my faith? And I think it's because a lot of people often see it as a kind of, my wife likes to describe it as a checklist religion, right? Like, if I do these 5 things today, then I am a good person. And it, among other things, defeats the point and reduces religion to a kind of transaction as opposed to a process of cultivating a better self.
I read somewhere that you said that it was your friends of Catholic faith that sort of helped to lead you back to Islam. And I'm interested in that.
Absolutely. I don't know if John Trusesky, who teaches at Xavier High School in Southern Connecticut, is listening, but he's a great math teacher, by the way. But I was always astonished by John because he was a person of very deep faith. And even in high school, with all the temptations and trials and all the things that high school presents and challenges us with, he never wavered in his faith. And I think what was amazing to me about that was not just the dedication, but the contrast, that here's a different faith that someone's taking seriously. So maybe I have the right to determine a relationship to religion that makes sense for me, that there's not just one way of being religious any more than there's just one way of having any religion. And so for me, seeing Catholics around me and the different types of Catholics there were opened my mind to how there could be different types of Muslimness. And certainly part of that is also because there just weren't a lot of Muslims around me, and I didn't have that kind of diversity. But it is, for me, one of the reasons why I think religious pluralism is so valuable and beautiful.
There's a phenomenon in this country, it's probably true in other countries, that the fastest growing segment of the population, I guess the religious population, are the so-called nones, N-O-N-E-S. These are people that have either rejected religion or just doesn't mean anything in their life. I'm assuming that applies to Muslims as well. But for you, was it a search to believe in God? Is that what you were looking for?
Well, I did have a period in my life where I questioned the existence of God, but being absolutely honest, and I do get into this in the memoir, it never really was a place of conviction. It was more of a position of convenience, right? If there is no God, then my life would be much easier in certain respects. But I never found that actually convincing. I've never really been able to understand the idea of a universe that exists without a cause and a source of sustenance. That to me, that it doesn't make sense that things are just here spontaneously. There's no material explanation that can suffice. But to go from there to actually realizing that belief in some kind of relationship in a way that changed my life and molded my life was a journey that took years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And if I'm really blunt and honest, I think a lot of it was just about growing up and coming to a place in my life where I understood how small I was and how much I needed community and family and obligations around me to provide me a sense of direction. And that's not by any means intended to be a knock on a person who identifies as a nun or anything of the kind. Actually, I think the phenomenon is vitally important for American Muslims and Muslims generally to understand. There is a wave of secularization that is rolling through, including the Muslim majority world. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I think that Islam is in this fascinating place where we have no idea what's coming next. We really don't know what Muslim communities are going to look like in 10 or 20 years. And I would like to enter that debate and shape that debate in some small way.
Well, in fact, as I mentioned, and I believe it's true, Islam, the fastest growing religion in the world. But as you write about that, there are many unmosqued Muslims, people, and I don't know if they're the nuns or they're just, there's something that doesn't connect them to their faith. And I don't think that's unusual for Islam. I think it's true, you know, we're all sort of unmoored these days, it seems.
Absolutely. I mean, in many conversations I have with friends who live in Muslim majority contexts and Muslim minority contexts, part of the problem is that we have not cultivated a sense of agency. And so people feel pushed out of mosques. And if you are an average person, let's say, with not particularly deep relationship to the religion, it might mean a lot to you. But if doors are constantly shut in your face and you are constantly told that you are less than, that you are inferior, that you don't understand, that your perspective is not important, the normal human response is simply to check out and go elsewhere. Very few people have the time, the resources, the ability to push back. And I've experienced this myself. I mean, I'm a person who, for example, speaks Arabic, who was raised in a scholarly family, who is a Sunni Muslim man, right? So I am the Muslim 1% in many respects, right? And I have been in religious spaces where I have felt absolutely powerless. And I can't even imagine what it must feel like if you are a woman or a religious minority or have a different perspective or simply don't have the right class or ethnic background for that particular mosque. And it can be remarkably alienating. And so there are a lot of unmosqued Muslims, some of them out of conviction and some of them maybe because they've been alienated. And we need to do a better job of trying to reach those people.
You talk about a religion of coldness, hardness, and distance. So these are the mosques, the sort of my way or the highway kind of mosque?
Yeah. And there's a lot of variability in American Islam. There's a lot of different types of Muslims, and it's a remarkably diverse community. So by no means am I trying to suggest that this is every mosque. But I think it is the case that there are far too many spaces in America and in other Muslim contexts where it is my way or the highway. And the mosque is controlled by a small group of people. It is very ideologically narrow. And at the same time, I recognize and respect that we are a very decentralized religion. So the way around this is not to force every mosque to be everything to everyone. It's to empower Muslims to have the confidence and the ability to start their own communities if they don't find what they need in the community that's nearest them. Some Muslims find that horrifying and scary. I actually think that's beautiful and liberating, that we don't need to all be on the same page on everything. A community is, in effect, a bunch of people who are disagreeing about the same thing. Just like in America, we argue over the Constitution all the time.
Right.
Muslims are just people who agree that the Quran is important, so they're going to argue over it. Doesn't mean that they'll come to the same conclusions, and it's kind of naive if we think that we can simply force everyone onto the same page.
So how would you describe then your faith?
So my faith is definitely a work in progress. I think for me the most important thing, I mentioned before those kind of three elements of Muslim identity. I think for me the most important thing right now is a relationship to God mediated through the texts and traditions of Islam and investment in community. I think identity is relatively less important, and I know that's a loaded statement, but the way I'll explain it is I think that if I want my tradition to survive and thrive in the world, it has to have something of significance and meaningfulness to offer. And identity is not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We know in the story of, for example, immigrant communities in America, I had friends in high school who would say they're Irish or they're Italian, but there was nothing really meaningfully Irish or Italian about them. They'd never been to Ireland or Italy. They didn't certainly didn't speak Gaelic or Italian or anything of the kind. It was simply a heritage. And maybe for some people, Islam is a heritage and that's fine. That's their choice. But for me, I don't think that that's either it doesn't fill me spiritually. It doesn't satisfy what I need existentially, nor do I feel it's enough to build a community that can thrive in the world. I do think that Islam has something to offer that's unique and important. And I would like it to be part of conversations, not simply as an identity marker, but as a worldview that can provide wisdom and guidance to people who are looking for it.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Harun Mogul. We're talking about his new book. It's called 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, How to Be a Muslim. And we are talking about Islam. And we want to hear from you as we always do on Radio Times. Give us a call. Give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Obviously, want to hear from the Muslims in our audience. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Harun Mogul about Islam. Is there an American Islam, an American version of Islam? As you've said, and it's obviously true, there are many versions. People live it in a different kind of way. But do you see an American Islam?
Absolutely. There are American Islams.
Yes.
I will say there's many iterations, but there's a fantastic book for the readers out there, and I'm sure many of the listeners are readers, by Richard Bullitt, a Columbia professor called Islam View from the Edge. And he basically makes this fascinating argument that in Islam, like in many other cultures, civilizations, and constructs, some of the most interesting stuff happens on the so-called peripheries, geographically, intellectually, culturally. And so on the one hand, American Islam is actually very small. And there's 2 billion caliphs is the title of the book because there's about 2 billion Muslims. There's maybe 5 million American Muslims, so we're literally a drop in the bucket. We don't seem to matter. And yet if you think about it, not only in terms of our dynamism and creativity are we a remarkable part of the global Muslim community, the Ummah, but arguably the most famous Muslims of the last century, or among the most famous Muslims of the last century, people like Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, were American. And so the story of Islam in America is not only a very old one, it goes back to literally the 1500s and 1600s, it predates the country by centuries, but it's also one in which American Muslims have shaped the ideas and perspectives of Muslims all over the world. I have stories from my parents and their generation of staying up late and tuning into BBC to listening to Muhammad Ali's boxing matches, and how surreal that is that in this small village in Pakistan, a bunch of people are crowded around a radio listening to a match, you know, well before social media and the internet, connected to and feeling the sense of pride that someone like us in some way is standing up proud of his identity. And so there is an American Islam, there are American Islams, and it's a thriving, fascinating part of the Muslim story.
What's so interesting is, you know, this is the largest religion in the world, and yet I think there's so much that we don't understand. I will confess, your book is called 2 Billion Caliphs. I Googled the word caliph because I kind of knew what it was, but I didn't really know what it meant. There were some other words in here that I also Googled just to hopefully be on the same page. So that raises some questions about some of the misconceptions and stereotypes about Islam. I know after September 11th, you know, you were one of the Muslims called on to sort of help explain what was going on in the world. And I think for a lot of people, they associate violence or terrorism with Islam. How do we detangle that?
So I think there's two things that need to be done. The first is we need to create space for representation. And definitely we've made a lot of progress in this country in the last decades toward in that direction. Certainly things have changed. There's far more Muslim infrastructure and space to be Muslim in different contexts. But that's not enough. A lot of the onus actually is on Muslims as well. And I actually was having a conversation recently with a journalist from Bosnia, and I pointed this out that, yes, there are violent Muslims. There are radical Muslims, and they believe that what they're doing is motivated by Islam. I think they're wrong, but they do think that. And that needs to be acknowledged and addressed and forcefully condemned. And it is. But the underlying problem is, how is it that you've got 2 billion people who are heirs to a culture and civilizations and societies that have done so much historically, who can't control their own narrative? And that, I think, redounds on where we have failed to invest as communities in what it takes to speak for ourselves and to build out our visions of the world, right? Don't tell me that Islam stands for this. Show me, and do it in such a way that other people cannot deny it, that they have to accept it and acknowledge it, and that they benefit from it.
Because I would say one of the sort of forces out there is, let's say, the Taliban or ISIS. I mean, I think, you know, in certain ways, that has controlled some of this narrative.
It has, and it has resulted in an environment where people can't see how Muslims actually live their faith. And that's a reality. I mean, just a few weeks ago was Eid, the holiday that finishes Ramadan, and we celebrated at the Islamic Center of Greater Cincinnati. And they had 3 different Eid services, and there were 7,000 people worshiping in suburban Cincinnati, which I was astonished by. And these are Muslims from everywhere. They're African-American Muslim families with roots that go back in the country, obviously generations. They're people who literally arrived as refugees weeks ago or months ago from every part of the world. Literally, American Islam is the most diverse Muslim nationality in the Muslim world, which is fascinating. Yep. And what you're describing, the Taliban, ISIS, is completely foreign and alien to the lived experience of the vast majority of Muslims. But until we are in a place where more of our stories are told and more of our perspectives are told, we have trouble communicating the urgency of that truth. And a simple example is what's happening in Ukraine. Now, by any measure, what's happening in Ukraine is absolutely horrific. And I think, like any person of conscience, I think that our supporting the Ukrainians in their fight for their democracy and freedom is absolutely the right thing to do. But Putin And the Russian state before him supported and engaged in similar actions in Bosnia and Chechnya and Syria. And yet the victims, because they were Muslim, we basically overlooked it. And actually, this is to me an argument for why understanding Islamophobia is so important, not just because any injustice to a people is wrong, but also because it's a warning sign, right? We saw that with the Nazis in Germany in the 1930s, and certainly there's no neat historical parallel, but the point being that when an authoritarian force rises in the world, they always pick on the most marginal, the most vulnerable, but then they escalate from there. And so had we paid a little bit more attention to the flattening of Grozny or the siege of Sarajevo or ethnic cleansing in Srebrenica or the mass bombardment of Aleppo, we would have understood what was actually what we were facing in the world. And we didn't, because we were able to look away because they're not like us. And so this is something that I think speaks to where all people in America need to be. In a position where we are more aware of the wider world and more understanding of its diversity in order to understand our own position and our own security, among other things.
So what do you want our listeners to know about Islam that they might not know?
I shared a passage from the Quran last night at the Free Library here in Philadelphia. And it's a short passage in which the divine describes divinity and says, I'll do it in a rough English translation, that God is neither a parent nor a child. There is nothing like the like of God. And what I said is that historically, many people have read such passages and interpreted that as a vision of a divine utterly alien and different from humans, which some people assume means Muslims experience their religion in a kind of state of submission and subservience to a menacing, threatening other. And actually what I pointed out is that when you read this a little bit more closely, what is being realized is intimacy, that a being that has no need for anyone or anything, that is utterly independent of the constraints that biological creatures have, is actually a being that is always available to you. There is no need or issue that is important or unimportant in the hierarchies we construct, because there's literal omnipotence in operation, right? There's no need to conserve resources or energy or attention. And so many people see Islam from outside as a religion of strict obedience, whereas people from within the tradition experience Islam as deep intimacy. And so we celebrate and we engage in and we venerate prayer and conversations with the divine individually and collectively, because they are a way of emphasizing our neediness and the sustenance and the joy and the beauty we find in that connection with something larger than ourselves.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And that's Harun Mogul, our guest on Radio Times today. Wrote a book a couple of years ago, How to Be a Muslim. He's got a new book. It's titled 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me pick up on some of the things you just said, but also to go back to your book. And there's some interesting things you say about Noah and Adam and Eve and some other people that we would recognize from the past. What does Islam and Judaism have in common? And I ask because you used to be part of the Muslim Leadership Initiative of the Shalom Hartman Institute. What do they share? What connects these two religions?
Well, I often joke with people that the reason Jesus has to come back is so that he can finally explain to everyone who he really was. Because the difference really here is that in some respects, Islam and Christianity share a lot in common, and in some respects, Islam and Judaism. And so on the question of Islam and Judaism, among the things we share in common, and there are many, the first is that we have a Unitarian conception of monotheism, that not only is there one God, but God is perfectly and totally one. Another thing we share in common is that we evolved historically similar kind of way of doing religion. And in Judaism, for listeners who are more familiar with that tradition, a lot of authority was historically invested in rabbinic interpretation, that text and debate and dialogue and conversation was the way you got closer to the meaning that God intended. And Muslim civilization functioned in a very similar way. It was a little bit more chaotic in certain respects, in part because it was a more geographically diverse tradition, and so there were different ways of doing that in different realities, and obviously the historical diversity politically also nuances that, but that's a major thing in common. And a third thing really is that, you know, as Semitic faiths, we have this belief that law and observance are ways to improve yourself internally. And so external obligation is a road to improving your internal condition. And there's dangers in that because sometimes people get stuck on the external. And then there's people who maybe from the religion's perspective go too far and just completely dissolve the external and focus on the internal. So there's a lot of that there. And then, of course, between Islam and Christianity, among the things we share in common is a belief that Jesus is the Messiah, mm-hmm. that he will return towards the end of time to fill the world with justice, and that Islam and Christianity are missionary faiths, which might be why sometimes we don't get along with each other so well, because we're competitors. We're
right.
like the Lakers
fighting
and Celtics
for the same people, right?
of world history. Yeah.
And how does Star Trek and Star Wars fit into this?
So I brought up a lot of Star Trek and Star Wars, and actually a woman I was talking to recently who was reading the book was saying, I was wondering if someone doesn't know a lot about Star Trek and Star Wars, yeah. they might be reading the book thinking, what is happening right here?
Yeah.
And there's actually two reasons. One is, for me, science fiction was, as a kid who was very sick and had a lot of illnesses, science fiction was something that gave me a lot of hope, that maybe this is where I am now, and this is maybe we are where we are as a country right now, but there can be a better future. And I think that's vitally important, no matter what your background is, your faith tradition, whether you have a faith tradition, there has to be a belief in a better world. And so science fiction writers, I think, are doing us all a great service in many respects. But the second reason is because I wanted Muslims to do that. That I don't hear a lot of Muslims actually try to imagine a future. We have a narrative of decline or stasis, that this is just this is how things are and things were better in the past. And okay. But what do you want for the future? What does it mean if I say I want to build out a Muslim future? What is that going to look like? What is that going to feel like? How are our values going to shape the world? And that's something I'm trying to encourage Muslim readers especially, but I think for all Americans, we need hope in a better future, because otherwise we find ourselves locked in kind of where we are now.
Well, let me quote what you say about Adam and Eve,
sure.
just to make a leap here. What distinguishes Adam and Eve from Satan is not moral agency, not even innocence. Adam and Eve made a mistake. Right after being told what not to do, they go ahead and do it. But unlike Satan, Adam and Eve fess up. That's what makes humans caliphs. Not that we don't make mistakes, not that we won't screw up, because we will falter, fail, hurt, wound, but we can make up for it. And use the word caliphs there. I mean, that's that we're fallible, right?
Yeah.
But we have to own up to that stuff.
And I think it's so funny that I never understood the importance of this. The passage you read is an explanation and a discussion of the story in the second chapter of the Quran, verses 30 to 40, about the creation of Adam and Eve and, by association, all humanity. And we are made to be caliphs. It's a term that means something like a steward or a custodian or a representative, that we are all of us, every single person, we are created by God to have obligations towards ourselves and the world, to make ourselves and the world better. And so we have agency, we are fallible, we will be held accountable for what we do, but that means that every person's life isn't just sacred, but includes a sacred calling. And so rather than a community where you keep your head down and you're told what to do, it should be very liberating, that if I have a vision of the good and it doesn't concord with those around me, I am tasked by a higher power to live out that vision of the good. And no human institution or construct should be able to prevent me from following that vision. Of course, you know, within reason, we're not asking people to engage in acts that are harmful. We also have obligations to protect each other as human beings. But where is that energy? Where is that passion? Why do we not see that in the Muslim world? And it's something that immensely frustrates me, that we are satisfied sometimes with mediocrity. And I look back at our history and I say, there were very smart people who articulated values and ideas and art and beauty and culture through Islam. Why aren't we doing that now? Why are we satisfied with just the way things are when they're clearly not enough?
Well, quoting you again and picking up on that, you say a long time ago, Muslim societies were powerful, creative, sophisticated, generous, and pluralistic for their time and their context. Today, the ummah, the community, is more riven by division than ever before, frequently dependent, neo-colonized, or occupied, and not a leader in many fields, or sadly, any at all. So what has happened to Islam?
It's a question that I think a lot of Muslims struggle with every day. Just a few days ago, I was at a basketball tournament in suburban Cincinnati, and a guy next to me was talking about the death of Shirin Abu Akleh, the Palestinian journalist for Al Jazeera, who was killed under, you know, we all know the story. And what he was pointing to was not just the injustice of her death, nor in addition, the moral travesty of the way the funeral was interrupted and disrupted, but why nobody seemed to care.
Yeah.
And he said, if this was a journalist who wasn't Palestinian, and she, of course, was Christian, but the larger point stands that there are these hierarchies in the world of whose life matters and whose life doesn't matter. And an occupation that is stretched on for decades and decades and decades doesn't really register. And so I think that for Muslims, what I want is that let's take that feeling and let's not stew in it. Let's build from it. Let's say, yes, this is not how we want things to be. Can we not find some way to advocate for the things that are important to us that improve circumstances for those to whom we have obligations? And that doesn't, by the way, just mean Muslims. That means everyone in the world. That means climate change. That means healthcare. That means energy, infrastructure, education, racism. There's so many injustices, and we will never be able to solve all of them. We are human. We are fallible. There are forces arrayed against people all the time. But the point is we should be making an effort. We should be dedicated to uplifting the world.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but, and I'm looking at the clock, but how do you do that? I mean, do you have to sort of have a reformation process?
Well, I think that reformation isn't the frame. I think what we need actually is education. I think we need to put more energy and effort into building religious confidence to go back to the very beginning. I heard a great talk, I think actually on NPR recently, but I can't place it. It's been in my head, by a woman who's a specialist in children's education. It was a fascinating discussion, and she was saying all kinds of brilliant things. And she said, you know, we want to cram our kids' heads full of information, and yet we literally have no idea what the world's going to look like in 10 years. And so instead of building memorization routines, and obviously there's certain knowledge that you need to know to function in the world, but she said we should really be emphasizing traits and capacities, resilience, confidence, creativity, and that's something that America historically used to do well. We were very good at thinking on the fly, at building on the fly, on organic forms of community, and that's what I want to see for Islam, is let's build capacity, let's build confidence, so that my kids, our kids, we don't know what they're going to face, but we want them to believe that they are going to be able to face it and to contribute to improving and ameliorating the world.
That's sci-fi vision of the future, right? Haroon Mogul is our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a new book, 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Haroon Mogul is our guest. He's got a new book. It's called 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision for a Muslim Future. He questions a lot of the orthodoxy of his religion and talks about embracing openness and questions and pluralism. We got a couple of comments here I want to read. One from Al-Ghassi Mu. Islam is already a modern religion that provides solutions to most of the problems of our world today, from taxation to women's rights, human rights, the freedom of religion. And I'm just scanning here. And tolerance. True? Not true?
I would take issue with the framing a little bit for two reasons. The first is that Islam is not a political program. It's an ethical and spiritual tradition that seeks to cultivate a certain type of human being and certain type of human society. So it does historically have priorities and values and of course, has been realized in different forms. But I don't know what it means to say Islam has a solution to taxation. That's not the purpose of Islam. The purpose of Islam is to make us into certain kinds of people with certain kinds of relationships and help us connect to our deeper purpose. It can shape conversations and lead us in certain directions, but does the Quran tell us if the speed limit should be 55 miles per hour or 65 miles per hour? Not really, but it does inculcate values that ask us to consider the sanctity of human life, the importance of trade and commerce, the need to protect the environment. How we translate those is very important. And so this idea that there is a single Islam that will lead to a single outcome is not just a myth, but a dangerous one. And the second thing I would say is that if Islam has these abstracted solutions, where are they? If we look at the situation of women in many Muslim countries, it certainly doesn't suggest that there's a kind of solution that's just waiting to be unpacked. Mm-hmm. No religion has these kinds of solutions, right? What I am saying is that we should have a religious tradition that cultivates people who want to push into these issues and address and improve these issues with the knowledge that we are limited as human beings. We don't know, right? We might try something with very good intentions and find out 10 years later that it backfired. And this happens all the time. And certainly we as a country, nobody, for example, hopefully, is debating whether we should have responded to COVID. But certainly we are now going to step back as this pandemic hopefully fades and say to ourselves, what could we have done better? Hmm. And that's not because we were necessarily bad people. We just maybe our ideas weren't the right ideas.
Here's a semi-related question from Richard. Explain why Islam is generally well behind the curve of advancing the human rights of women.
So I don't know if I'd say it's well behind the curve. I think the challenge really is that Muslim societies, it's really a question of unfortunate historical trajectories. So by the 1400s and 1500s, and I'm sorry to get into the weeds, but I think it's really important to helping us understand this issue, Muslim societies around the world had realized certain types of social structures and institutions that were remarkably successful for their time. And so as a result, these models were copied across very different Muslim societies, from northern Russia to Southeast Africa, to Indonesia, to Senegal, and there were these broad similar features. And they were all knocked down by colonialism. Why that happened is another debate. The point is they were basically sent backwards, sent reeling, right? Mm-hmm. And so they have been in a process of reinvention. But imagine for a second that you are trying to reinvent yourself at the same time as you keep getting colonized, right? You keep getting attacked. There's constant interference in your societies, right? From the age of empires to the Cold War to the War on Terror, right? Anytime there is forward momentum, we are pushed backwards, 10, 15, 20 years. And the final thing I would say is when you look at American Muslim communities, you see remarkably successful women from all different backgrounds who have strong Muslim identities and Muslim practice. That doesn't mean that the situation of Muslim women in American Muslim spaces is always ideal, many times far from it. But I take my own mother as an example, right? She was one of seven sisters, all of whom were educated, all of whom were quite religious and are quite religious. And they don't see that as in conflict with their Islamic identity. The question is not just what is happening, but why is that thing happening and what are the forces that are moving it forward and pushing it backwards? And if we understand those forces, there are structural forces. And we've had conversations in this country, maybe not enough, but we have had on structural injustices. And there are structural historical forces that make certain outcomes less likely or more likely. And so we should address the individual circumstances, but we can't do them without addressing the structural forces that operate around us.
You explore a lot of the teachings and the life of Muhammad, but you also ask, why did the prophet marry so many women and at once? Why didn't he ban slavery outright? What was his position on homosexuality or bisexuality or really any orientation other than heterosexuality? Are you questioning Muhammad, the prophet?
I'm asking us as a community to do a few things. So the first is to be willing to look at our religion and the texts and traditions of our religion honestly. And if they disagree with certain secular orthodoxies, conservative, progressive, what have you, then we should at least be honest about that. Before, whether we take a position for or against, whether we move in one direction or another, we have to acknowledge that. The second thing is that we do that with compassion, that we understand that these are incredibly sensitive issues because they deal with human dignity, the sacredness of life, our need for intimacy, companionship, equal participation in society, and so they should be every conversation should be accorded that respect. And the third point I make is that this is precisely why we need political secularism, not cultural secularism, but you do need a neutral state and a public civic space in which my moral commitments are not necessarily or even ideally seen as policy proposals, right? To go back to the question of policy proposals.
Sure.
So I'll give you an example. Many conservative Muslims believe that Muslims should only marry other Muslims, that for the sake of children and your spiritual development, that you should have a life partner who shares your worldview. And I can certainly see the logic to that. I've seen in Jewish spaces, many people make the same argument. In Catholic spaces, many people make the same argument. We would find that discriminatory in a certain respect, but religions are discriminatory. That's part of the definition of a religion. There's a difference, however, between preaching that and encouraging that and then enforcing it communally on everyone in your community. That's a step too far, but certainly a step way too far is to turn that into a policy proposal. That's why I find a lot of our conversations around the culture war so problematic. I may not have – I am socially conservative on a number of issues as a matter of personal morality. I certainly don't believe that my moral views are the business of the state or any state. I can't impose them on anyone, right? My life choices are not someone else's life choices. And maybe it's easier for me to do that because I'm a minority and so I have a certain sense of give and take. You know, you do what you want. I do what I want. We meet where we can. We work together where we can. Where we can't, we agree to disagree. And I don't think that's strange. I have friends who are atheists who – basically think I have an imaginary friend. Like I've oriented my entire life around a fiction. So, right. I mean, mildly speaking, they might think I'm a little crazy, and yet we have a respectful relationship. And I don't know why we find that so hard to do as a country, and certainly in Muslim contexts, it's a much more loaded and difficult conversation because it's a majoritarian context. And you know, but I think I'm just trying to get us to look at these issues honestly and openly and compassionately.
It kind of reminds me about how we think about our founding fathers here. Like, you know, these were brilliant men of their time that created a country, but obviously had a tremendous amount of baggage that today, you know, is absolutely horrifying. Slavery, of course, being the most obvious thing. So how to reconcile the past and the present.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we look at the issue of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and slavery, for example, he didn't ban slavery in the sense that we would understand it, but also he didn't live in a modern bureaucratic state. He lived in a tribal society. And so his way of addressing slavery was to change the moral norms around slavery. So there were rhetorical moves. So, for example, he said that the name that God loves the most is Abdullah, which means slave of God, which was a direct knock on the whole idea of slave owning. That no, you're not actually a master and that's not a slave. You're all slaves. We're all slaves. We're all slaves of God. Let's get out of this horizontal frame and get to a vertical frame. He said that, for example, if you were in that kind of economic relationship, you have moral obligations, right? That anyone in your employment, anyone in your service must be fed at the same standard you feed your own children, must be clothed in the same clothes you clothe your own family, right? So it was a moral way of addressing the institution. There was no policy proposal, and then the children of slaves cannot be slaves. So when I looked at it as a whole, it suggested to me that he was trying to destroy the institution through the mechanisms available to him, right? There were no state governments. There were no bureaucracies and departments. Those things didn't exist. So rather than, you know, a simple, you know, from here to here, we have to understand that the moral possibilities and constraints in that environment are not the constraints and possibilities of our environment, which is why I think the earlier question on or the earlier comment on Islam's policy on taxation is so problematic. There was no health insurance back then as a simple example, right? So like, what does it even mean to say we should vaccinate everyone, right? Like, how would the Prophet, peace be upon him, have vaccinated people, right? Like, these are questions that there's no simple translation. You have to do a little bit of creative thinking and think, what are the values? How do they apply now? What are the unintended consequences? And have a debate.
And have a debate. I'm thinking about what you said about Adam and Eve. At least they accepted that they, you know, they accepted or acknowledged that they did wrong. I mean, do we expect the same? Did Muhammad do anything wrong?
Did Muhammad do anything wrong? So in the Muslim tradition, the way to understand the figure of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is that we see that he is the ideal embodiment of morality in the world. He is the standard by which we judge ourselves. And I often, when I talk to young audiences, I say that there's a principle in Islam. We never condemn anything he did because we believe he's the best of creation. But that doesn't mean that we have to do everything he did. It doesn't mean that his context is our context. So the ways he did certain things aren't necessarily considered applicable to Muslims in different contexts, right? It's a very complicated conversation. So on issues like prayer and basic morality and moral principles, how we recite the Quran, so on and so forth, that's a model. But in terms of our day-to-day life, in the nuances of existence, we have to then use our own minds to apply that situation to now. And this is, I think, one of the central principles of Islam that's so challenging for Muslims, is there's no divine stamp of approval anymore. In the absence of any prophet, because we believe Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the last prophet, we're all basically on our own. The most we can do is have a debate and say, well, this is something that he said, and this is something he said, and now we're going to have to make sense of it, because he's not here to tell us, and God is not going to announce to us what the right answer is. And this is why I make such a powerful, insistent, repeated, you know, call for moral agency, because really we never know if we're right or wrong. In that grand sense, right? Mm-hmm. We are just doing the best we can, which is why having a democratic conversation is so important. So we can arrive closer and closer to the truth and, like you said, be willing to acknowledge we're wrong when we're wrong.
Let me quote you one more time. I've been quoting you a lot during the show, but here's something you say about Hagar. She represents what we must come to represent. Our formative history is expulsion, migration, relocation, reinvention. Leaving home isn't a sign of meaninglessness or a problematic rootlessness, as blood and soil nationalists would have it, but an indication of a divine favor. Exile and displacement can be marks of chosenness. In Islam, being pushed out of your home isn't suggestion that God hates you. It's the strong hint that God believes in you, even loves you. And that you're an immigrant. I mean, you know, I don't know if your family was pushed out of Pakistan, whether they were, you know, pushed or pulled over here, but the kind of, I guess, rootlessness that people often feel. But you're saying that there's a message there.
Absolutely. And it's a not so thinly veiled criticism of some Muslims who I find are a little bit too quick to line up with the conservative right in America and not realizing the blood and soil nationalism that operates within that. And our religion is actually a religion founded by a nomadic people who thought nothing of traveling hundreds or thousands of miles repeatedly in the course of their lives. And there's a reason why Islamic spirituality and religiosity is so Spartan, because it's a religion of people who are nomads. You couldn't pick up a building and move it. You had a prayer rug maybe, and all you ever needed was to know the direction of Mecca, and that was pretty much what you needed to do what you needed to do. And I think that in a world in which we are increasingly interconnected, in which we move about a lot, then that spirituality could or should have certain appeal, but it also liberates us from feeling like place is some kind of ultimate marker of moral significance. Place is meaningful. Sure. It really is. Of course it is. People are attacked. People who are pushed out of their homes. It's a gross injustice. It's a tragedy, and it should be addressed. But it also doesn't mean that we create hierarchies around place, that if someone is attached to a place and I am attached to a different place, it doesn't mean one place is better or one place is worse. And incidentally, I would say that also applies to people, and I'm saying this as someone originally from the Northeast and some of our bubbles where we call it flyover country and we look down on it as if there's nothing of value in those places.
And you live in flyover country.
I live in flyover country, and I often fly out of flyover country, which is a paradox too big for my mind to understand. And so really for me, that's what I want out of Islam, a spirituality that is intimate and direct and portable, that we can take with us. And again, that we have the confidence to carry this with us wherever we go and wherever we find ourselves, because we have no idea. We really don't. A few years ago, COVID would have been to most Americans utterly unimaginable. And a few months ago, the idea of a massive land war in the heart of Europe would have seemed unimaginable. We don't know where the world is going to take us. And all we know is whether we will have the confidence to meet the world as it confronts us and to try to make it a better place, or whether we will shrink from it or turn back in hatred and anger.
Harun Mogul, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times, for staying over and being with us here in our studio.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Harun Mogul's new book is titled 2 Billion Caliphs, A Vision of a Muslim Future. Also wrote a book a couple of years ago titled How to Be a Muslim. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also sign up for our newsletter. We send it out every Sunday, and it gives you a heads up about what's coming up the week of coming up on Radio Times. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thank you for joining us.